Welcome to Health Matters. This is the mental health edition of Health Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Vegan, psychologist, along with my co-host, Shelley Visconti, counselor and marriage and family therapist. This evening, we're discussing the topic of romance. Should be fun. We invite our listeners, all of you, to call in with your comments and your questions. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. 1-800-552-8502. This evening, we have as our guest USA Today's best-selling romance author, Kimberly Lang. She was noted by USA Today as the best-selling author in 2010.
A best-selling. Not the best, but a best-selling author.
What's wrong with the best?
I would love to be the best, but I don't want to claim something that I really can't back up.
Okay. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you.
If I want you to be the best. Kimberly, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, would you? So our readers will know who you are.
Well, I am a...
Our listeners will know who you are.
Well, I hope some of them are my readers. That would be great to have some of my readers out there. But I am a romance novelist. I've been writing romance. I sold my first book in 2009. So I've been writing, been a full-time writer ever since then. I have a background in English, though. My degrees are in English. And I was an English teacher for a while, actually. But I've been a long-time romance reader. I've been a romance reader since I was very young. And so this is like a dream come true job.
Well, welcome, and we're very happy to have you with us tonight. I may take the position of being kind of a Neanderthal because I am just a man.
That's all right.
And so I may be a little bit naive and not too knowledgeable about this subject, like most of us men probably are not too knowledgeable about it. We also want to ask our readers to... These could be readers too, though.
Okay.
Our listeners and our readers. To call in and participate with us. But if you are listening out there to our programs and you would like to suggest some topics for us to address, please let us know, either calling in and letting us know or writing to the station at redriverradio.org. Anyway, I have this first question, and Shelley brought this up to me and said that we were talking about your writing, and I didn't know what this term meant. Bodice ripper. I've never heard that. Could you explain that?
Well, a bodice ripper, I mean, it actually refers to a very specific type of book that was very popular in the early 70s into the 80s. And they are the historical, very sexy romance novels. But they're historical because the women were wearing bodices, and the bodices were often ripped either in violence or in passion, or sometimes violent passion. But that's where the term comes from, are those early romance novels in the 70s and 80s. Now it's become a rather pejorative term that people apply to the genre as a whole. And so it's not a very descriptive term actually anymore, because what that particular term conveys doesn't really represent romance anymore.
So it was that part of a cultural norm where the belief was that women really didn't want to be sexual and they needed to either be coerced or forced into sexuality or something?
The lack of consent in romance novels in the early 70s and 80s, which really kind of bothers people today, and they should have a problem with it. It was a cultural thing. A lot of folks around in the 70s, only about 40% of American women believed that that premarital sex was okay. And it wasn't that 60% of women were virgins on their wedding night. It's just we still had that attitude of good girls didn't. And so by having a heroine say no up front and then have the hero overcome that no in some manner, either through just his sexual persuasion or his physical, you know, his physical strength, that then removed the slut label from being applied to the heroine and by extension the reader, because she said no, and so then she had sex, and now she, you know, once the deed's done, and she can go on and have more sex throughout the book. But it just kind of got over that initial, it sounds terrible to say that, but it became this way of relieving the heroine and by extension the reader of that guilt of premarital sex.
So then she could go on and enjoy the relationship.
Exactly.
And so on.
Exactly.
So you're saying this was like the genre was in the 70s and 80s, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
How has how has this changed, or how has culture changed?
Well, romance novels, with the publication of The Flame and the Flower, Catherine Woodwiss's seminal work, 1972, that kind of changed everything. That was the first true bodice ripper novel. And that book was, I mean, ridiculously popular. And within, I mean, it sold within, it was so influential, within the next 3 years, over 150 books very similar to it, those lush, erotic, historic novels, had been released, and they'd sold like 40 million copies. It completely changed the way, you know, it completely changed romance in, as a whole. And while I said that in the early 70s, only 40% of women thought premarital sex was okay, by the time we get into the 80s, we had rocketed past the 50% mark. And so that stigma of good girls don't do that was starting to fade away from, at least from romance novels, and in reflection of society as a whole, I think. So the books do change along. A book from 1972 is not representative of, I mean, a book from 1972 could not be more different than a book published this year. And so, but the books that are published this year are very reflective of today's times.
You know, you and I were talking just a minute or two before the program, and we were talking about sort of the values that you as a writer today, writing a romance novel, that you're trying to promote, and that I guess are the background of your writing,
mm-hmm.
the values that are involved in romance novels. Can you say a word about that, or am I even asking that question properly?
You mean like positive sexuality and things like that, or positive? Well, I'm not sure.
Well, the idea that that women enjoy sexuality, that men enjoy sexuality, that this is part of our human nature, and that coercion is not necessarily a good value, that free choice and participation and consent are important values in human relationships?
I am a huge proponent in my books and in life in general of enthusiastic consent. I think it's not just consent. I want enthusiastic consent.
Enthusiastic, I like that.
That's kind of your goal, is enthusiastic consent, I think, in any relationship. But, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how. I write books that I enjoy reading, basically. I am my first reader, and so I'm going to write a book that I enjoy, and I'm going to create a heroine that I can identify with. So she's going to be very reflective of the times in which I grew up, the times in which I am living in now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have to give her issues and situations and things that feel true to me. And I'm going to have to create a hero that I can fall in love with, so that my reader can fall in love with my hero. So he's going to have to be very representative of what I'm willing to, you know, what I think an ideal man should be, what I think a man should be, and what he should, how he should be acting in a relationship. But, you know, the sexual romance novels aren't just about sex. There's so much more going on inside the romance novels that, you know, to say that it's just the sex in romance novels that has changed kind of cuts short, and, you know, kind of gives short shrift to everything else that's going on.
If it was just about sex, it would just be pornography.
It would just be pornography.
Pornographic,
yes,
writing.
Yes.
So a romance novel is more about relationships,
romance,
and situations.
Yes.
And solving problems.
Yes.
And commitment sometimes.
Oh, definitely.
Passion sometimes.
Totally.
And love.
Love, totally.
Ooh.
That is what romance novels hold up as kind of the ideal, is love. That's what we all, I mean, I'd admit it, I'm in love with love. I think love is an amazing, amazing emotion, probably one of the most complex that's out there, because why do you love one person and not someone else? But love is really the one thing that really kind of makes us human, in my opinion. It's the one thing that we all have in common, regardless of cultural, sociological, you know, all the other things that separate us. That need to love and be loved is like the human emotion that we all share. And so that very much, that ideal, that getting, being in a relationship where you are loved and you are, and you're giving love, and it's an egalitarian, mutually supportive, wonderful relationship, that's what we're holding up as the ideal. It's not just great sex. It's not just, you know.
So would you say that it's the love or the passion that motivates your characters? I mean, what is the driving force for your characters?
Well, I think passion drives everybody at some point, but passion only gets you so far in a relationship. and then there has to be something else.
Compassion.
Compassion. You have to, you know, there has to be great sex. You can't hold a relationship together. There has to be more than that in a relationship. So while chemical attraction and passion may drive the characters towards each other to begin with, that's not going to hold them together.
Well, usually it's passion that starts the relationship.
Yes.
But it can't sustain it.
No.
I mean, it's got to move to compassion.
Yes, it's got to have something else there.
And ultimately commitment.
And romance novels, one of our requirements is that there has to be a happily ever after, you know, or at least, at the very least, a happy for now. Our characters have to be together at the end of the book, ready to move forward with their lives. We put them through hell for 200, 250 pages. So at the end of the book, they are committed to each other, they're committed to the relationship, and they are ready to go forward. Now, sometimes they're getting married, sometimes they're engaged, but they are together at the end, ready to move forward and conquer life together.
When I think about relationships, particularly marriage, or they don't have to be married, but I'm thinking about what can two people co-create together?
Mm-hmm.
What can we, myself and somebody else, what together can we co-create? But that takes some passion, it takes some compassion, and it takes a lot of commitment to
and
co-create.
Patience.
I'm sorry?
Commitment and patience and learning to tolerate each other's differences and even enjoy each other's differences.
Yeah, when I do marital counseling, I'm always talking about mutual goals and values are needed in a quality marriage. Mm-hmm. The ability to communicate effectively. Intimacy is needed, and a capacity to enjoy differences, because I believe that human beings don't necessarily enjoy differences, that we like sameness. So I would be attracted to people that are sort of similar to me and less attracted to people that are very different than I. And so the ability to enjoy differences, I think, is enriching. And that makes for a marriage, the ability to have two people that are very different and don't depreciate each other, but appreciate each other.
Well, you have to be able to, I think the thing about that we look at in romance novels is, how do these two people bring out the best in each other? What is it about when these two people are together that they are making each other better?
Well, that means you're committed to the other person's well-being.
Yeah.
The other person's growth.
I mean, they have to be able to pull together as a team. They have to be able to work together. And they need to be, essentially, they need to be better together than they are apart. So there has to be enough complementary things going on there to work together with each other. And sometimes that's the opposites attract thing, is where one person might be weaker in some areas and the other person is stronger in others. And then they make each other better and stronger and more complete that way.
You know, we think about teams. You said they have to be able to work together as a team. And you think about the National Football League and all the energy and effort that they put into playing a game and practicing and becoming a team. And probably we don't work on our marriages as much. We don't practice as much. We don't practice to get it really, really right. Again, I invite not only our listeners, but also our potential readers of romance novels to call in and participate with us and bring in your two cents. 1-800-552-8502. Call in with your questions, your comments, your criticisms. We want to hear from you. We would like you to participate with us in our discussion. And we ask you to enthusiastically consent and become part of our program. I love that phrase, enthusiastically consent. I mean, we've always emphasized consent now, but now I like enthusiastically consent.
It should not just be a yes. It should be a yes.
That's good.
Sorry.
Can you do that again? How should the yes be? You know, we've heard, Shelley, did you want to add anything? I don't want to dominate her.
Well, actually, we have a question.
Okay.
It's actually from a scientist.
Uh-oh.
She would like to know if there's been scientific data that endorphins increase with the feelings of romance.
Hmm. That's for you to answer.
I am not a scientist. I was an English major. Well, I mean, isn't that the whole purpose of endorphins? Endorphins make you feel good. So things that make you feel good, you know, give you that endorphin high. I mean, that's with romance novels. I mean, in every novel that I write, I get to fall in love again for the very first time. I get to experience that first kiss. And we all remember that, I mean, that first time, you know, when you first meet someone, that feeling that you get, or is he going to kiss me? Is she going to kiss me? And, you know, how's it going to be? You know, that lead up to it. I get to live that, you know, over and over and over again in every book that I write. And so there's a release that you know, I think that books give you a release of those endorphins the same way a romance, not, you know, is kind of a substitute for doing it in person. You get to relive that over and over again. And anytime you have endorphins can be addicting. And, you know, there are worse things to be addicted to than the feel good endorphins released by a good book.
So your personal research says that yes, that endorphins are released during romantic periods. Is what I'm hearing you say.
I cannot speak to endorphins released. I do not wish to speak outside of my area of expertise. Okay.
Well, it's an interesting question. I know endorphins are released, you know, when people are running, are they not? Mm-hmm. I would think when people are engaged in sexuality. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to imagine that if at moments of great joy that they wouldn't be also released. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when you're talking about love, I think one of the greatest feelings, like you said, is to experience yourself loving someone. That's really a high. It would be It would be hard to imagine that an endorphins were not involved in that. Let me ask you this real mm-hmm. quickly. You know, I've heard a lot of criticisms about romance novels, and that they probably reinforce, you know, the notion that, you know, women really do need men to be happy, and they're incomplete without men.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't we men God's gift to women? And because women are just incomplete without them. And do you think that romance novels kind of reinforce that archaic and stupid notion?
Absolutely not. I mean, I really, that criticism always just grates across my very last nerve. Yes, you could tell as I start to, you know, tense up a little bit. I mean, like I said, there's no books say that a woman needs a man to be happy, because the stories of these, you know, these arcs that these characters are going through throughout the story, the reason why they are not already coupled up at the beginning of the book is not only that they haven't met the right person yet, they themselves are not in the right place to be in a successful relationship. So part of what our characters are going to go through...
You mean
through,
like not right with themselves?
Not right with themselves, okay. Right. They have their own issues. We call it baggage. Mm-hmm. They have baggage that's keeping them from being happy, whatever that is, you know. And so the baggage could stem from anything, you know, but that there is something holding them back from being able to be happy in a relationship.
Like bad learning in their histories?
Yeah.
In their histories?
Trauma, bad relationships before, mm-hmm. King Oliver, you know, whatever. You've probably heard a lot of people talk about the bad things that happen and how it affects their being your therapist. You've heard probably some really horror stories. So our characters at the beginning of the book are in that place where they have their baggage. They haven't sorted through their baggage yet. Now, their whole life is not necessarily in turmoil. You know, our heroines are carrying on jobs and, you know, living their life, but they just haven't gotten to that point yet. And so the character arc of the book is going to take them to where they're good with themselves. They overcome their baggage. They have to unpack that baggage and deal with that baggage. And then that makes them ready to really commit to the hero. And usually the hero and heroine are unpacking their baggage together.
So unpacking the baggage really comes to what I think is a fundamental rule of mental health, and that is that you have to have a quality relationship with yourself before you can have a quality relationship with someone else.
Exactly. They can't, I mean, the hero is not going, and the hero and heroine are not necessarily going to be the person that fixes someone else. It might be the, you remember the line from the movie As Good As It Gets, she makes me want to be a better man.
Yes, yeah.
That's kind of, you know, at the heart of this idea that I'm talking about, is that this person makes you want to be more, makes you want to be better, makes you want to be ready to commit, mm-hmm. makes you want to get past whatever it is, makes you want to get your act together. And so it's not that the heroine needs the hero to make her feel complete. She has to get to where she is. She has to get right with herself first and then she's ready to have a relationship with the hero.
You know, when we surround ourselves with quality people, all of those quality people want, or they want, they make us want to be better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like when you're playing on a good basketball team, people better than you, you're going to play better basketball.
Exactly. Exactly.
So being a better person. But I really think the idea of unpacking the baggage and realizing that in order to have good relationships with other people, you've got to have a good relationship with yourself to start with.
Yeah, I mean, she's not, you know, neither one of them are ready at the beginning of the book for, no matter how successful they are, no matter how driven they are, no matter what else they're accomplishing, they're not emotionally ready for a mature relationship.
Well, and in therapy, we see that time and time again, people jumping from relationship to relationship, trying to fix themselves, when really it's, you know, you can't fix yourself through someone else.
Right.
It's work you have to do on your own.
So, I mean, I realize I kind of went roundabout with that question, but I hope I answered it, because like I said, it's not that the woman needs the man to be complete. The woman doesn't get the man until she is ready for it.
Well, if she's an incomplete woman, she'll probably choose an incomplete man.
It's not going to be a healthy relationship. I mean, if you don't understand yourself and you're in a bad place, other place, how can you have a really healthy relationship with someone else?
No, that's true. Absolutely. Again, we invite our readers to readers. There we go again. Our romance novel readers and those of us who have never read a romance novel, we invite you to call in and become a participant with us. 1-800-552-8502. I noticed I was thinking about, you know, good relationships. I was thinking about the idea of acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Do your romance characters, do you focus on the journey that they go through to self-acceptance? Because once you're into the area of acceptance, there's nothing more to do. And there's also nothing wrong with you. Your thoughts, or am I off base here?
The thing about self-acceptance, you know, she has to be the heroine. I mean, I'm using she because we're talking about the idea of women needing men, but you know, it's that same thing of a good relationship with yourself, accepting herself. Whether, I mean, it's not that, you know, I'm not sure that. It's very similar to what I said earlier, that idea of accepting who you are and then becoming better or fixing what, you know, not denying your problems and things like that. So accepting whatever it is about you, whatever's happening, and then working on it, becoming an active participant and a doer in your own life to make the changes that need to be changed to get you right with yourself before you go.
Shelley, do we have someone calling in?
Yes, we do. We have a caller. Go right ahead with your call. I mean, with your question.
Yes, I was curious to know if, first of all, does the author consider herself a feminist? And in 2015, what exactly is the role of the romance novel?
Tell me your name, sir.
I'm sorry, my name's Greg.
Greg, okay. Did you hear his question clearly?
Was it? Am I a feminist? Was that the first part of the question?
Yes. Are you a feminist? And kind of what is the role of the romance novel in 2015?
Sorry, I didn't hear it quite well. Yes, I very much do consider myself a feminist, a very strong feminist. I actually just gave a lecture Tuesday night about feminism in romance novels. I do believe that. I'm a woman. I'm a feminist. I'm a mother raising a daughter. These are all issues that make, you know, that are important to me. And so anytime anybody starts to say that romance novels are anti-feminist, I start to get a little twitchy about that. But in 2015, I mean, the role of romance novels hasn't particularly, I think, changed. I mean, they're there to entertain. That's the first of any literature at all, is there to entertain primarily, first and foremost. So as entertainment, that has not changed at all. In 2015, though, we see romance novels have changed with the times. They're not the same novels they were 30 years ago or 40 years ago or even 10 years ago. So they, you know, not all, you read a book from 1974 and it doesn't really hold up well against what we would consider a modern woman. But what's very interesting to me is that the women who read those books in the 70s and 80s that were problematic with consent and bodice ripping and things of that nature, they raised the generation of women who are now writing romance novels, and we don't stand for that. Our readers don't stand for it. The editors don't stand for it. The publishers don't like it. We have moved past that. The acceptance has gone. You know, we now want that enthusiastic consent, and so the novels of 2015 are just trying to be as reflective to women's current our current lives. That's all they're trying to do, is be reflective and be something we can identify with.
Greg, did you want to add any more or question
further?
Did I answer
that?
Oh, he's hung up a bit.
Sorry. Thank you, Greg.
Define feminism. You said, I am a feminist. What does that mean?
I mean, the basic definition of feminism is, you know, that men and women are equals. And I mean, and I write books where the men and women are equal. And so, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, someone being better than somebody else or somebody doing something better than somebody else. It is men and women are equal, and they should be equals in a relationship.
We were talking with SB Magazine the other day about another topic about how women are trafficked, you know, often. And we were talking about women making only 78 cents on the dollar compared to men and so mm-hmm. on. So I like your definition of feminism, and that being men and women may have differences, but they are equal.
Well, and just to add on to that, the idea about the trafficking and the I'm sorry, what did you say after the
human trafficking and 78 cents on a dollar?
Yeah, the thing about romance novels.
Well, hold your thought.
Okay,
let's take another call.
Yes, we have another call. We have a caller from Bossier City. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi. Yes, I've been listening to you here, and I think it's very interesting. And you made a comment about a heroine or a woman being able to be happy within themselves first before they can find happiness, you know, with another person. I've recently gone through a divorce, and I didn't hear about that concept, you know, until just recently. And I'm in my late 50s. And knowing this in high school in the 70s would have better prepared me all through my young adulthood up to this point here if that was taught in school or some other way. Or at least when you're writing novels that might be geared to the young teenage girls. I don't know, maybe you can write some for young men. I don't know. But that point really needs to get across to people, because people were trying to tell me this, and I didn't have a clue what they were saying because I'd never heard of that concept before. But as I went on and on, other people were telling me the same thing. Like, everyone else understood this, but I missed the whole entire boat for, goodness, 40 years, you know? I don't know. What can you say about that? I mean, I'm still trying to find that happiness, you know, within myself. I've done it with some hobbies and stuff, and I'm a better person now because of them. I'm healthier now because of it, but I'm not 100% there. And I'm not sure if I ever will feel a complete person without somebody that I can be in love with that shares that.
Tell us your first name.
Well, I'd rather avoid saying that because people might recognize me.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to welcome you to the human race. I think you're doing great to learn what you're learning. And your comments are so right on. Do you want to speak to him?
We were talking earlier about, you know, what men could learn from reading romance novels and things like that. And I mean, I think everyone should be reading romance novels. That's just my stance, because I think they're fabulous and wonderful books. But I do think that we tend to, in general, and I just watch it in my own daughter and what she's doing in school and things like that. We don't teach our kids how to,
have relationships.
How to have relationships.
That's
and what
right.
good relationships are and what healthy relationships are. We don't fight back necessarily against the media when they put forth you know, examples of relationships that aren't necessarily healthy. And so I would love to see more of that. I would love to see more of working with, you know, people before they end up in relationships that end up unhappy. I would love to see us telling them more about, you know, Are you, you know, do you know yourself? Do you know what you're looking for? You know, what's holding you back? I would love to see more of that before people do end up in unhappy relationships.
You know, we talk about school. We don't teach a lot about relationships in school. We don't teach a lot about emotion. We don't teach a lot about conflict resolution and so on in schools. One of the things that I have always been an advocate of is teaching music and art and anything that requires creativity. Because when a person is learning to be creative, they're really learning to go with inside themselves, look at their own compass, create things, and that leads to really having a quality relationship with yourself. The artist is a step ahead, because out of the artist's work comes out of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And
Shelley would back that up too.
Yes. But enthusiastically.
Yeah, I just think that's a great question that he.
I'm glad to hear though that he's made that discovery in himself though. I think that's wonderful.
He's complaining that he's only learning this at 50, but I know people that have never learned it.
Oh sure. Oh, yeah.
And so I think he's
a step ahead of a lot of folks.
He's ahead of the gang. He may not feel like it, but he's
so good luck.
I do too.
I hope you find someone.
Shelley, do you have another caller?
Yes, we do. We have another caller. We have Jody from Shreveport. And Jody, you can go right ahead with your question.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I was listening about the role of feminism and equality. And I've lived in the South my entire life. And I really just had a question about, does the equality take away some of the chivalry towards relationships, the doors, the asking for your hand in marriage, some of these traditional things that, you know, if you're on equal footing, it's not, you know, I always felt like the man is supposed to be that protector, that head, and there are certain things that we're expected to do and certain things that, we need to do in order to fulfill those roles, especially in the South where these traditions are longstanding.
I think that the idea that feminism and chivalry, I mean, so many things like opening doors for people, I think that's just common human courtesy that we should be doing for each other regardless of gender, regardless of...
Men do that for men?
I open doors for women. I mean, I open a door when a woman we both approach, and I open the door and let her go first. I mean, it's just politeness, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Good manners too. I mean, I think the idea that, you know, that the South has, you know, ideals that we put upon men about their behavior, that they have to act in certain chivalrous ways, you know, treating, you know, the South is still the home of be a lady and act like a lady. I don't think that, you know, being nice to people and being, you know, these things, these ideas of, you know, opening doors for people and holding chairs out for people and things like that necessarily have to be gender related, and that they don't necessarily have to undermine feminism. Yes, I am perfectly capable of opening a door for myself, but I don't have to, if someone else holds a door for me, it does not diminish me in any way to accept that someone has opened a door for me. So I think the idea of we can be nice to each other, we can make these gestures to each other without diminishing, you know, without it being an insult or trying to diminish me in some way, I think that's the happy medium that we need to try to find. And we see a lot of chivalry in romance novels. I mean, it's still alive and well in romance novels.
Okay. Now, I had interrupted you earlier. You were making a point earlier. Do you remember what it was?
We were talking about pay parity and...
Oh, that's right. The 78 cents on the dollar.
Yeah. And I know what I wanted to say. When we talk about romance novels, one of the main arguments I have about the positives in romance novels is that romance novels value women and women's ideas and women's the things, you know, women's occupations and preoccupations. I mean, in a world where we still undervalue women quite a bit with the pay, you know, we still haven't reached pay parity, things with, you know, attributes that are given to men, you know, positive attributes for men are considered unladylike. We know we don't like aggressive women. You know, an assertive woman is bossy. These are all types of things that, you know, we haven't quite reached that level of equality in our society where we still judge women based on their clothing and instead of their accomplishments. And romance novels really value women. We put the emphasis on women. They are the center of the story. Their wants, their desires, their needs, they take precedence. So we are putting we are valuing women and telling people that women have, the romance novels tell you that as a woman, in and of yourself, for no other reason than the fact that you are alive, you have value.
Well, I was, I'm reminded of how I wanted to encourage my daughter growing up. And I always wanted her to be feminine. I couldn't create that for her. She sort of had that and learned that from her mother. Mm-hmm. But I certainly wanted her to have an equal balance between femininity and competence. You know, I didn't want her to be just pretty and quiet and agreeable. I wanted her to be able to do everything that her brother could do. If it, even masculine things like changing a tire on a car, which is an important characteristic. If you're driving cars and you're a woman and you're out in the, you know, on the road or something like that, you probably ought to know how to do it. But competence and femininity to me is a very attractive combination in a woman.
Competence is competence. I mean, we all have to be competent, regardless of whether you're pretty or not.
I'm not sure that years ago women were really taught to be competent. I thought they were sort of taught to be quiet and to be pretty and compliant.
Well, and that is one of the ways, I mean, when we talk about, you were asking about how romance novels have changed, and the caller asked about how romance novels have changed into 2015. You see a lot of that in the, you know, pick up some romance novels from the 50s and 60s, and those women are doormats. I mean, they're not terribly competent. But you get into the 2015, we have perfectly strong, competent, capable women running their lives in these books. And so, I mean, there's the idea that those two things, that, you know, femininity and competency are separate. That may have been a case in the past, but it's very reflective today in our, in romance novels, at least. You're pretty and you're competent. You know, you gotta be able to care for yourself.
One of the questions that I was interested in is what do you think men can really learn from romance novels? And I think you're kind of hitting at that. But before I let you speak about that or ask, or let you, I'm going to let you speak about that. You get that? Before you hit me and decide to speak about it on your own.
That's Shelley throwing things.
Yeah. Whack. Let me invite everybody to call in, or anyone who does, 1-800-552-8502. We've had some really good calls from...
great questions.
Yeah, great questions, even from anonymous people. But call in 1-800-552-8502 and join our conversation. I will now permit...
How chivalrous of you.
Yes, I'm being chivalrous. You know, I guess the idea is that if men don't understand women... and they want to know more about women, then reading a romance novel might be an avenue into gaining some understanding. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, romance of our readership, 85 to 90% of our readership is female. And so when I write a book, I'm not really trying to think about that possible 10% of the male population who might read my book. I'm totally focused on my female reader. What does she want? What is she going to want to and what is she going to enjoy in this book? So and I'm a woman, so I think like a woman. So I tell men when they ask me why they should read romance novels, I tell them that, well, you'll see how women think. If you're confused about how women think and why they think that way, well, read a romance novel. You're right inside a woman's mind. You can follow her thought process. And then I laugh about how, and you can, because romance novels are often written also from, you know, we have a hero's point of view as well as the heroine's point of view. You see a female writer working through the male point of view as well. And so how women, when you say, I don't understand why women think this way and why would she think I thought that? Well, a woman thinks differently than you do. And here's how she thinks you think in a romance. You know, you can see how women, not only how women think, but how women think men think. A little bit in romance novels, and it gives them a little bit of insight, I think, into women. There's nothing, I mean, that's just my thing.
What's so curious about that? So you're a writer, and you're writing about a male heroine, a hero, and you're writing about how women think he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
So, how, from a woman's point of view, how do women think men think? Did I get that right?
I brought you a book. I'll let you read it. I mean, it's hard to say because, I mean, My husband, the first time he read one of my books, he was the one that told me, he's like, that's not how men think. And I was like, what do you mean that's not how men think? That makes sense. You know, this is I was following.
You're far too logical.
It made sense to me, you know. And so, you know, he was the first person to tell me, he goes, that's not how men think. And I'm like, well, that's how you should think, because that's how I think you should think. We would get along much better if you would just, you know,
think the way I think.
Think the way I think you should think.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm walking in a big thinking circle here, and I'm probably angering people out there. But I mean, it's for men who want an insight into what is important to, you know, what is important to women, what do women think about, what do women, you know, they could learn a lot from romance novels. I mean, what is going to make a woman's heart go pitter-patter? You know, what type of, you know, men often think that they need to make the big romantic gesture, you know, that they need to. Around Valentine's Day, men talk to me all the time about, well, what should I get my girlfriend? What should I get my wife for Valentine's Day? I don't know your wife. I don't know your girlfriend. You should know. But you don't have to do these big romantic gestures of flowers and chocolates and candies or whatever it is. You know, by reading a romance novel, it might show them that romance is often the little things, the small things that show you that, you know, I know this woman and I know what this woman wants and what this woman needs. And sometimes, you know, that's not flowers, that's not candy, that's taking her car to finally get the front end aligned because she hasn't had time to do it, and so you're going to take time off of your day to go and get her front end aligned, because, you know, that's romance. It's not, romance is not just chocolates and flowers and long walks along the beach.
I think doing dishes is very romantic.
I think so too. Yeah. I very much think doing dishes, ironing. Yeah. Ironing is sexy. Men who iron are sexy.
Gosh, I hope my wife's not listening. Psychologist by the name of Gottman described some characteristics of the healthy marriage. Mm-hmm. And one of the four characteristics he identified was the unexpected gift or the unexpected good gesture. You know, so it's a gift, for example, at a time when there's no occasion.
Right.
Or it's a gesture, like you said, that's not expected, not asked for, but just done in a way that surprises the other person.
There was a book. It was called Porn for Women. It was a little picture book, but it was, you know, it was a picture of a good-looking guy shirtless at the sink, and it's full of suds and it's dishes, and he's holding a scrubber in his hand, and he's like, "No, honey, you've had a long day. Go sit down. I'll take care of these dishes." You know, and that was the you know, that was the porn for women, was a man who would do dishes. You know, and. That's taking it a little bit to an extreme, but the idea of knowing what is important to your partner. And that's what, you know, you see in romance novels that people always think it's about the helicopter ride coming in to pick up the woman and take her off to the island. It's going to be most likely the gesture that really resonates in the book, the one that really just grabs your heart and doesn't let go, is going to be the smaller gesture that, you know, he found, you know, he was out in a bookstore and he knew she wanted this book.
Somebody told me the other day the three magic words are, "I've got this." So that someone is, the wife or the woman is saying, you know, "I've got X, Y, and Z problem." And the man says, "Don't worry, I've got this."
But I think that also goes both ways.
That's right. Yeah, that's really true.
It goes both ways. Knowing that, and that's part of the thing of knowing someone, and that goes back to that whole thing of fitting together and making each other better and being able to be a team. Not everybody is equally strong in the same places, and being able to say, "Oh, I've got this, you've got that," that's
it's a great feeling.
Yes.
1-800-552-8502. Call in with a question, a comment, a contribution, or anything that you want me to ask Kimberly to do or tell her to do. Anyway, let me ask this question real quickly. Mm-hmm. Is there any harm done to relationships as a result of reading, or are reading romance? I guess this is not a good question for you, but
it's actually something that Shelley and I talked about. Is that, you know, this idea, and it's something that, you know, I've heard before. I've heard it as, you know, as a slam against romance novels. Is that,
well, I wondered if it gave people with an unrealistic ideal.
Well, that's the thing, is that's what we normally hear, is that, you know, it's giving women an unrealistic ideal about what a relationship should be. And first of all, I think that's crazy, because, you know, romance novels are about mutually satisfying, egalitarian, respectful relationships. And I think that should be a baseline. I think all relationships, I think if you're going to be, you know, have a long-term commitment with someone, you should be with someone who respects you and loves you and treats you as a partner and an equal. So that type of thing, I hate it when people say, oh, it's an unrealistic expectation, because to me, that's the baseline. That should be the minimum. Everything else is gravy on top of that. But I think that where people start getting the idea that they're harmful is because if there's something wrong in a relationship, you know, a romance novel might shine a little bit of light on it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you're reading the romance novel and you're like, wait, my honey doesn't communicate with me. He doesn't, or she doesn't, I'll be equal with it. You know, that I'm not feeling as fulfilled, or I'm not being, you know, I wish I had that level of communication with my partner that I see in this book. You know, so it might shine a light on places where relationships could be improved. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to, I don't think it can cause the problem, because if the two people are communicating great, then me asking you about your communication skills isn't going to hurt the relationship.
You're right.
Yeah, so if a relationship is already strong, reading a book isn't going to break up a relationship.
Exactly. Yeah. If you're in a good relationship, yeah, there's nothing I can hand you in a book that's going to.
But if you're on shaky ground, then who knows what could.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But it also could be a model for how to move beyond the shaky ground.
Sure.
Or how to solve a problem.
Oh, I mean, romance novels put out this idea that, you know, this could happen to you. Go try this at home. You too could have a great, you know, satisfying relationship.
Now, listen, you're here today, and I just have to ask you about 50 Shades of Grey.
All right.
I mean, a lot of people are talking about this. People are reading it, and I have not read it. So could you talk a little bit? Have you read it?
I have read it. I have not finished the book. I've read most of it, but I did not make it all the way to the end. But I will say that 50 Shades of Grey, it's a phenomenon right now. I mean, it's huge. And like many phenomenons, it's hard to say exactly why this one particular thing has caught on. I'll be honest, 50 Shades of Grey is not one of, it's just not my cup of tea. So that's why I couldn't finish the book. I had issues with it. But the problem is that it's not representative of romance fiction. It's not representative of BDSM romance or even erotic romance, much less mainstream.
All right, now wait a minute. You just put in some letters there.
You're a therapist. You don't know what BDSM is.
Oh, I do, but I don't know what our listeners may or may not know.
The BDSM, the kinky bondage, dominance, sadomasochism, submission, that the whips and the chains and the blindfolds that are so popular that's come out with the 50 Shades of Grey really kind of brought that to everyone's attention.
So that's very different than a romance novel that you're talking about.
Well, romance novels, there are erotic romance novels that contain BDSM elements that very much, you know, a romance novel, I mean, the sex in a romance novel can be all the way from none at all to way kinkier than 50 Shades of Grey ever hoped to be. 50 Shades of Grey isn't even the first romance in that particular area. We've been writing BDSM erotica since at least 2003. There's been really wonderfully done novels in that subgenre of BDSM erotic literature, erotic romance.
Could you cite a title or something?
Sylvia Day's Crossfire series. Anything by Joey W. Hill. She writes great stuff. And Lorelei James, she has a new series out. She does great stuff. Those are really, I recommend those books to people who have, you know, either heard of 50 Shades of Grey or want to know what to read next. Those are really wonderfully written, very hot, very sexy, and very well nuanced, and very, you know, really interesting, good books to read. That goes, the sex is there and it's hot and it's interesting and it's all that, but it's also this
consensual?
Really one, very consensual. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Non-consent, any type of non-consent and dubious consent really does exist in a niche these days. It's kind of, you know, you're not going to see a lot of dubious consent coming from a mainstream publisher, which is why 50 Shades of Grey is so interesting, because it started off as Twilight fan fiction. It found its popularity on the internet first and then was bought by a publisher and and put out after it was already very popular. So when I tell people it's a niche book that escaped its niche, and you know, and it's, and who knows why, but it's brought up a lot of good conversations.
Well, again, summarize for me exactly what your, I don't, are you offering a criticisms of 50 Shades of Grey or your concerns about it? Can you summarize your, I mean, I think I've sort of lost what you've said.
Like I said, 50 Shades of Grey has a huge fan base.
Yes.
I mean, it's a huge fan base. It is, I am not a big fan of 50 Shades of Grey. It's, I have some issues with the book, mainly in the sense of consent. The lack of consent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anytime you're talking about something that popular, you have people on both sides, people who love it and people who hate it.
Right.
And so, like I said, my issues with the book, the things that I see in the book, I'm an English teacher. I was an English major. I love to get in there and argue about stuff. And so, you know, the issues of consent in that book have been a topic of conversation across, you know, for lots of people. Like I said, I have issues. I like enthusiastic consent. I've already, I've already made clear my choice of, I love big enthusiastic consent.
Well, you know, from a mental health point of view, consent is antithetical to choice and to living your life according to your own compass.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're living your life according to your own compass, you're not going to be manipulated or coerced, you know, or forced or raped, or things aren't going to be done to you against your will.
Mm-hmm.
So I like your concept of enthusiastic consent. I think that's just absolutely great. Again, we ask anyone who wants to call in 1-800-552-8502.
And we actually have an email question.
Okay.
For Kimberly.
Okay.
Kimberly, are you married?
Yes.
And how do you bring romance into your relationship?
Yeah, that pitter-patter you were talking about earlier.
I am married, and I've been married for almost 20 years. So as far as bringing romance into my relationship, I mean, I write romance all day long. So, you know, I think people expect me to, you know, to have large expectations of what romance, what my husband should be doing to romance me and things like that. But it, like I said, for me, it's the little things. It's, one of the sweetest things my husband ever did was before I was published, and for a holiday, he actually went out, and there were these envelopes, because we used to have to mail in our manuscripts, and it's like a 300-page manuscript, and you had to put them in these special envelopes that didn't rip and tear and all that kind of stuff. And they were like the Mercedes of envelopes. They were expensive. You know, a box of them was like $50. And he went out and bought me a box of these envelopes and gave them to me with, you know, send out your manuscript, go do this. And that meant everything to me. I mean, it was showing his understanding of what I was doing, how important it was. It showed me his support of it. And so to me, that kind of gesture is one of the most romantic things, you know, somebody can do, is to show you that they support your dreams and your goals. And here is a tangible something to help you achieve your goal. It's the envelopes to mail out your manuscripts.
How many envelopes did he give you?
It was a box of 30, I think.
30. And how many books have you written?
I've now written 17.
So you have 13 more envelopes.
Well, I sold before the envelope. I sold before I ran out of envelopes.
Oh, that's
so
fabulous.
Yeah, I sold long before I ran out of envelopes.
Well, that just tells me that he was in touch with your dream.
Yeah.
And was supportive of your dream.
And to me, that's romance. I mean, like I said, I am the worst romance novelist when it comes to like Valentine's Day and stuff, because I don't want flowers. I'm always on a diet, so I don't need chocolate. When I see the rose petals, down the floor leading to the bedroom, my first thought is, who's going to clean that up? You know, I'm not, which is, so I'm not exactly, the, what you would normally call the romantic, the stereotypical romantic type. You know, like I said, send me a box of envelopes. Show me that you support my dreams. Show me that you support what I'm doing. Hold down the fort while I go and come on radio shows and things like that. I mean, he's back home in Alabama being single dad right now so that I can come out and do things like this. Those are things that show me that's real romance. That's showing me love and support.
Let me ask you another quick question. How would you, from a romance point of view, define the word intimacy?
Intimacy and romance do not necessarily go together. Okay. I think romance is a lot about chemistry and hormones and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think intimacy is about trust. And that's, to me, the basis of intimacy would be trust. Being able to form, to trust that this person, that you can tell this person your dreams, that you can tell this person your hopes, that you can put yourself.
So it's being open
and it's trusting that person to not only be open to what you are giving, but to treat it with care. When you give them this knowledge of yourself,
right,
that they treat it appropriately.
You give them your soul and your heart and your limitations, your strengths, your weaknesses, your fears.
Well, and I think you can have intimacy without romance. I mean, that's mm-hmm. why we have, best friends and things like that. I can have a very intimate relationship with someone that I trust very much. But it doesn't have it. Once you add in that chemistry and that, the attraction, you've given them an edge. You've given, having that, giving someone that knowledge about you, you're almost giving them something to use against you. And in a romantic relationship, that hurts even worse.
We had a program recently on curiosity and creativity. And the psychiatrist that joined us, Dr. Sewell, one of his major thoughts is that everybody makes sense if you know enough about them, mm-hmm. which I think is good. But the other thing he said, and he's an artist, he was saying that for him, being an artist is playing. And that he just plays. And when he plays with statues or paints or whatever, it's just fun for him. And if the product is satisfying to him, then he's really, in touch with that inner compass that is truly mm-hmm. unique to him. He's really being himself. I was trying to think about writing doesn't seem... Now, I'm a scientific writer, but writing seems... It doesn't seem like play to me. And you're a writer. Is that...
It's totally play to me. I mean, it's work. I'm not going to say that it's not work. Writing is hard. But when you're, if I didn't enjoy it, if I wasn't having fun, if I wasn't entertaining myself, it would be very hard to, to actually do this. And so it is very entertaining and fun to be a writer, because you are your first reader. I am my first reader. I'm writing to entertain myself first and foremost.
I want to enthusiastically thank you, Kimberly, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And ladies and gentlemen, Kimberly Lang, a romance writer, very glad to have you with us today. And I want to thank our questioners, Greg and Jody, and our anonymous questioner, etc. Thank you for being with us this evening.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, you should consult a mental health professional or physician. This show is available for download, or you may listen to a podcast of this program on our website, redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided this evening by Wally Derleth and Tim Snell. Production of Mental Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake. Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community, located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. I'm Shelley Visconti, along with Dr. Mark Vegan. Thank you for listening, and good night.